The Junes are 75 and 9, the awesome Wendy's in their prime, the bowl is quick, the batsman fine. Remember? Do you remember? Nope, I can't remember, that was too long ago. Yeah. Holding Marshall, Garner, Lloyd, and Mighty Bid. Mighty Bid. They were going for the hat trick, the greatest team that lived, that lived. They swagger, then they stagger out. They shake their heads, they cry. How on earth did we lose to a team that played Yash Palat?
This is ESPN 54 Talking World Cup. I am Srinath Sripath. And on the show today, we have the Polite Inquiries duo who've come back together for a podcast gig this time. First up, George Dobell. First time on Talking World Cup. Really happy to have you, George, finally joining us from Manchester. Are you?
That's right. I'm in Manchester. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Lovely. And of course, Jared Kimber, who's been here quite a few times. Jared, where are you joining us from?
Let's say Manchester, but I'm not sure it is. It's like, I'm in Lancashire. Look, the sign in my car park says, beware wild animals. So I'm somewhere.
Somewhere in the middle of England. And it's as good a time to talk about the English cricket team in a World Cup for all the good reasons. It's been quite a while. George, let's start with you. It's been a long time. It's been 27 years. Yeah. For the first time, we're seeing, in my living memory, I don't remember England making a World Cup semi-final in my lifetime. It says a lot. It's been a long, long time. What's changed for them? What's the biggest sort of takeaway from these games that you've seen, which you followed so closely?
Well, I think the first thing that bewilders me is what wild animals Jared has to look out for. We don't have any. Is it sheep? Anyway, why has it been so long? Well, they haven't been very good. You think of some of those campaigns in the World Cup since 92, and they've been horrific, haven't they? 99 in particular, and probably 2015. Those are probably the worst two. But they've been characterised by a lack of planning, by late changes of decision-making. The World Cup was never the priority. So, since 92, it's been pretty grim following for English cricket lovers, and it's about time they got there again.
Jared, it's a question I know that's bewildered you for a long time. As an Aussie, seeing a serial winning team that's never seemed to go off the boil in World Cups, including this time, what struck you the most about this team? I think you had predicted that England will go far, but it feels like Australia could stop them once again. What's the biggest change that you've seen with this lot? Because it's been a long, long time, as George says.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's just tactical, isn't it? They've found a bunch of young players who hit the ball very hard, and they've backed them. And they also, a lot of it is probably data-driven. I think, through Andy Flower, Owen Morgan, Nathan Lehman, and even all the way through to Bayliss, I think they've just looked at it and been like, well, if we could score over 350 every game, and we've got a bunch of guys who can help us do that, then we can win. And so there's a sort of freedom that you're allowing them. You know, you look at Jason Roy, at times he's gone through a couple of fallow periods, but because they keep saying, look, we back you, you know, keep going. When he gets in form, we know if he makes 100, it's very hard for England to lose because he scores so quickly. So I think that, you know, that's the real change. So it's weird, I suppose, being an Australian fan and automatically thinking England is going to fail and them not failing. I don't know quite how to process that as a fan, but they have been quite entertaining to watch over the last couple of years. In fact, if anything, they're being almost dull at times because they've been so predictably good, which is, you know, if there's anything you want of England, I think predictably good is maybe one of the worst things they can ever be for world cricket.
Just on that, I mean, I don't think it's been data driven. If you remember the end of the last World Cup, De Moors had said, we'll have to look at the data. Now, he didn't actually say it, but it implied that England were too data-driven, that they were too careful, that they were too scientific, and they didn't allow free rein to their natural ability and their emotions and all the rest of it. So I think they have very much embraced the alternate route, which is just express yourself, freedom, just the most uncomplicated cricket they could possibly play, and trust the fact that they're really quite good these days. So while they do have these people in the background who will give them statistics and what have you, while Owen Morgan or Trevor Bayliss are particularly utilising that sort of method, and I actually think they're making a positive out of not doing it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, George. But at the same time, you can't help but look at the way that the team has actually been put together. There is... Even if it's away from the Bayliss side of things and more towards the selection, I think Bayliss has said, we've got a bunch of blokes who can club it. Let's put them together. And there's a lot of different factors that go in. But you can't go away from the fact that they have decided to hack the middle overs by scoring far quicker than any other side and stack their batting lineup deeper than any other side. Those are proper, data-driven things. Those are not just, a natural evolution, because lots of teams could have tried something like that. England have looked at it and gone with it. But I also think they've done it because of their strengths. And as you said, I don't think they're telling Alex Hales or Jason Roy to go out there and we want you to be this, this amount by this over. But they're literally backing those strengths. But they're also plugging the team together with guys. I mean, they've had a team that can bat to 11 at times. There's a lot of strategy that have gone into this. And then I think on the field, I think you're right. I don't think they worry about that as much. I think they allow the players to back themselves. It's a really interesting mix.
Just on the players, George, the one thing that there was a stat that popped up after the last win against New Zealand saying that the lowest number of ODIs that an England player has played outside of Jofra Archer is 49, which means that they've identified these guys quite early. They've played together for almost the last 4 years. Is there or has there been a sort of certain Australian sort of ruthlessness with the team selection, because they've eliminated quite a few guys whom they thought was not part of this plan, part of this fit? I'm thinking of guys like Ravi Bopara, who was around 4 years ago, and thinking of an Ian Bell. I'm sure there are a lot more names that you can bring up here. Has there been a sort of trusted or a well-designed process to eliminate the guys who don't fit this brand of ODI cricket that they've been known to play for the last 4 years?
Up to a point. I mean, it sort of came straight after the last World Cup when two or three very high-profile players were, well, either retired anymore. So you've got Ian Bell, who was the top run scorer in ODI history for England at the time. James Anderson was the top wicket-taker, and Stuart Broad as well. And I guess there was a ruthlessness there, but it sort of came from a fairly easy position in that England had been hopeless. And so when you hit rock bottom, it actually provides everyone the courage to make decisions. So I don't think any of them have seemed particularly ruthless. I mean, David Willey will feel, and justifiably, that he's unfortunate to have been left out, having played a big part in this side over the last couple of years. But you look at Jofra Archer, even David Willey's mum going, well, fair enough, Jofra's really good. So they're hard decisions, but they sort of had to be made, didn't they? The other interesting one, I suppose, is Alex Hales. But, having seen that evolve, it didn't seem that ruthless at the time, to be honest. It just seemed that he had become a distraction and a complication. And actually, he was the reserve batsman anyway. So some of these things have fallen together. You think that Jason Roy actually only got back into the side when Alex Hales was first suspended straight after the Bristol incident. And I think he and Johnny Bairstow really started their partnership then. And what would happen is whoever got in would score so many runs, they made it impossible for them to be dropped. And that's how Johnny got into the side and established himself. He was just too good. I don't think anyone thought he'd be opening at the World Cup when he got his first opportunity, but a strike rate of 110. I mean, it's completely undroppable. So some of these things just fell into place. It hasn't felt like it was particularly ruthless, to be honest. It's just felt like they were picking the best players without a lot of emotion. And I think they continue to do that.
The one thing that's kind of struck me as an outsider watching English teams for so long, but you've said that it kind of feels weird that they're in the semi-final as an Australian, etc. The one thing is that 2 games to go in the league phase, England were in danger of elimination. There was the home pressure. They'd not played well in games before that. And suddenly they've come up against 2 really good teams and pulled it past them. There's almost no contest against New Zealand. They were close against India. Do you see them, or do you see the criticism that they're good on wickets that suit them, which is basically the batting tracks? Is that a fair criticism? Has it played a big part in them making it to the semi-final? Or do you see them as an improved side from 2 years ago when they lost to Pakistan in the Champions Trophy?
Look, I mean, until we get to the finals, I suppose we don't know that answer, do we? And we also don't know what kind of pitches we're going to get for the finals. I think that a lot of the preparation for the English team was set around the fact that it was going to be in England and the pitches were going to be very good. I know there was obviously some complaints over that semi-final pitch last time when they played Pakistan. And it makes sense. They've set up their game for a certain kind of style. And if the pitches don't particularly help them, they're not as good a side. That doesn't mean they're a terrible side, though. This is one of those things. They're probably the best flat pitch ODI side in the history of cricket. They're not the worst ODI side in the history of cricket when the ball seams around a bit. They're not the worst when the ball spins a bit, but they do struggle maybe a little bit more when it's slow, just perhaps because of the kind of batsmen that they have. But I think you have to look about these things realistically as well. Generally, tournaments, and this is T20 tournaments, one-day tournaments, all those sorts of tournaments are won by the best bowling side. And there's probably a reason for that. You know, when you get to the finals, there's probably a reason that that specifically happens. So if that's the case, England is not the best bowling side. So, you know, you can understand. And that particular game, the Pakistan game, the Pakistan bowlers bowled incredibly well. It wasn't just that the pitch was slow. They just bowled really, really well. And that sort of thing is going to happen. And the other thing is just you have to be a bit realistic here. If England win 70% of their matches, they also lose 30%. And people just sort of ignore that every time they've lost a game in this tournament. But that is you know, a very, very normal thing to happen. And if the pitches don't suit them as much as normal, you would expect them to be slightly less than 70%. And that's still any team that's winning over 60% of their matches in cricket, you know, home and away especially, is a fantastic cricket side. And that doesn't mean that they're a perfect cricket side, because no one would say this is a perfect English cricket side. What we would say is it's an incredible batting lineup and with a lot of very good and very well-defined bowling talent.
I'm going to just flip that around and ask you the other question. What could have been the consequences of not making it to the semi-final in a home World Cup? Because like you said, like it's very well known, it's the fact that they've been preparing for this for the last 4 years. It's kind of been a mission for them. 2019 has been sort of a milestone they've been looking forward to. You've kind of written about it in great detail. What would have been the costs and consequences of not making it to the semis, which they were really close to doing, actually?
Yeah, in a really prosaic sense, it just would have been disappointing for this bunch of players, because obviously they put a lot into it and they would have failed to deliver on their ability. But that happens to teams all the time. In a larger sense, in a global sense, I think it would have been very bad for cricket, and I genuinely mean that. In that cricket is in a precarious position in the UK. It is not a big sport. It has become a niche because it's been starved of oxygen, really. And it needs some success, gain some traction in the mainstream media. Now, even this World Cup is happening only really behind paywalls. There are clips on the BBC and there's a bit more interest in the papers. But I think it needs something quite dramatic to get to get into the public consciousness again, and winning a World Cup. The frustration is that this team is tremendously enjoyable. You know, even when they lose, they do it with style, because they can be obviously terrible on their day. But they're actually very entertaining. You know, the hitting is outrageous. They've got a couple of really good, fun, fast bowlers. They've got a leggy, quite a nice bunch of guys who are very keen to embrace their role as ambassadors for the sport. I know that people might not always have seen that, but they really are very good at that. And I think we've got such an opportunity to sort of market them, to sell them, and to try and attract a new generation of supporters, which the game desperately needs, that winning a World Cup behind a paywall will do that. But it gives the game a chance. And if they hadn't got there, I really think you're starting to get to the stage where cricket is becoming, I don't know, such a niche sport that you start to worry about its viability in the long term. I know that sounds over the top. There is no room for complacency about the future of cricket in England and Wales.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I think especially we're kind of recording this a couple of hours after news has come in that Sky will bring it to the wider audience outside the paywall if England qualify for the final. Now, they're just one step away and it could prove to be a massive moment considering what's preceded this. Free-to-air, like George says, has kind of robbed cricket of the oxygen of eyeballs among the wider audience. Jared, you've lived in Australia and you're seeing this kind of blockade of cricket from the mainstream and the regular audience in England. How different has it felt? Has this cricket genuinely harder to access here, or is a big deal being made out of this whole thing?
No. I mean, it's a huge problem. Me and George have probably written about it hundreds of times and talked about it on podcasts, and we do interviews about it all the time as well. It's a huge problem. And, you know, you basically, cricket almost needs to be passed to you as some sort of a legacy item by your father or your mother or your auntie or uncle in the UK at times. You know, you need to come from the right kind of family, the old Giles Clark comment, or, you know, have an Asian background, or perhaps if you're from up north and, you know, someone in your family plays cricket. But it's, you know, I remember a first-class cricketer who grew up in Nottingham, who went on to play for Notts a little bit. He went to a state school and he played one game of cricket his whole life when he was at school. So it's not in the schools. You can't see it on TV. It's, you know, it's sort of hidden away in the papers a lot of times because it's not the biggest story. You know, you only have to look at the Women's World Cup football, how big a story that has become in the UK because it is so accessible to everyone over here. And those things matter. And cricket is not an accessible game to people in the UK. And there's lots of different reasons why that is the case. But it's not that cricket is always the biggest sport in Australia or in other countries. Like Australia and New Zealand are very, very interesting. You know, when the World Cup was on in New Zealand, you felt like you're in a World Cup country. You felt like you're in an Olympic country, if you know what I mean, where everyone was worried about the World Cup. Everyone was talking about it. There were signs everywhere. You haven't felt like that in the UK this time, you know, and that is a huge, huge problem going forward. And, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, even England winning this World Cup, and hopefully, you know, more people will watch it with Sky's decision, but I'm not sure that even that is going to save it. But as George said, I think it would help.
The other thing, George, interesting, Jared mentioned the whole Women's Football World Cup here. England did win a World Cup at home a couple of years ago. Has that done anything at all to boost cricket? I'm sure it's done something for women's cricket. And do you see a moment like that happening if England win or get to the final of a men's World Cup? Will it be an equivalent big occasion, because the women's team has been doing well for quite a while, and of course women's cricket is growing now more than ever, not the same case not a long time ago.
Yes, look, it's helped, but it's helping from a very low base, and I'm not sure that they've capitalized on it quite as well as they could, because it then became invisible again. So look, it was a great day, and there is more participation in women's sport generally and in cricket too. But I don't know, has it really taken root? Has it become mainstream like football? Well, it hasn't. I wish it had. I just think there's so much good going on here. There's so much that should be easy to sell and celebrate. And I get all the benefits of the money that Sky and other broadcasters have ploughed into the game. But as I keep saying, even billionaires suffocate without oxygen, and the game is desperately cried out for exposure. Did the Women's Cricket World Cup help? I mean, I look at what's happening with the Football World Cup, and there is no comparison. All I can think is if English cricket had the same exposure, it would benefit in the same way. And on the bright side, you know, some games in the 100 are going to be broadcast on the BBC. 11, I think it is, or maybe it's just 11 across the season. There'll also be an international T20 game between England and Australia broadcast free to air on the BBC next year, and I think one of the women's games too. So there is a little bit of hope, but we are getting to the stage where it's getting pretty desperate, and honestly you could not exaggerate how urgent the problem is, because whole generations are growing up having no exposure to the sport at all.
Yeah, I can't imagine that, looking at cricket in India, which is kind of big because broadcast and access is so easy. It's something that's hard to relate to, but I completely hear what you're saying. The other thing for viewers and listeners who have not been following it is the fact that the Women's World Cup was getting at least 10 to 12 times the eyeballs and exposure that the Cricket World Cup is getting, which is massive considering the World Cup, the Cricket World Cup is happening in England and the Women's Football World Cup is not happening there. It's happening in France, and BBC had the rights while cricket is behind a paywall, which is kind of a big multiplier effect if you're looking at 10, 12 times the people watching it, despite a World Cup happening at home. Moving on, because we've kind of covered the free-to-air thing on another episode as well, and we're in danger of going down the same train once again. George, some thoughts on Owen Morgan as a leader, because there is a story which I was reading that Brendan McCullum turned out to be the MC at Owen Morgan's wedding. They've kind of grown close as a couple of cricketers. And the fact that England's rise has its roots in the drubbing by McCullum's men in 2015. How much is Owen Morgan inspired by McCullum as a leader, and how much has he tried to follow that template with England? I know they're two completely different sides, but has there been a genuine influence on his captaincy?
Yes, it's massive, absolutely huge. And it's not just about playing cricket, but it is partly. So they became friends in something like 2011, 12, something like that, playing in the IPL. They just found that they got on. Well, that's one thing. But actually, Cullum played the game, was inspiring. I mean, he was the sort of guy that you wanted to watch even when he was in the field. He was so wholehearted. He was so 100% in everything he did. He oozed entertainment and charisma. And he played this wonderfully fun, aggressive, attacking style. Now, I know what you're thinking. There's a lot of people who do that. You could say the same about, David Warner, up to a point. Actually, you could say many of the same things about David Warner. He's incredible in the field. He plays that brilliant, used to play this brilliantly aggressive style. There's a lot to like there as well. But McCullum did it while being still being true to himself, which was in a much more friendly, less abrasive, more respectful way, which fitted much better with this England team. So he showed, I think, England and Owen Morgan that you could play fantastically entertaining cricket without being a bit of a dick. And that breath of fresh air for England. If think back to the English summer of 2014. England played Sri Lanka and India. There was the Jadeja incident or non-incident, whatever happened at Trent Bridge with Anderson. There was England sledging the Sri Lanka players massively at Leith. England were hard to love that summer. They were a fairly nasty, fairly mediocre side who seemed to have aped the Australian method without any of the talent to back it up. They were just nasty, really. But after the World Cup, they realised that that wasn't them for a start. You know, a team with Moeen Ali and Jos Buttler and Joe Root in it. That doesn't suit them. So they looked at the way that McCullum did it. They looked at the fantastically entertaining style of his side during that World Cup, and they realised that was the way you can play cricket. You can play in a way that you're comfortable with, that you're proud of, that makes your supporters proud, without in any way compromising your aggressive, competitive side. So, yeah, the McCullumisation of English cricket has been hugely welcome, and actually I think it's spreading right around the world, and a very welcome thing it is too.
Jared, not too many people better to turn to talk about Australianism and likability as cricketers, because right now, while, as George has written widely about, that England is the side that everyone wants to beat. But aside from that, there are no individual names which people kind of bear a grudge about in this England side, isn't there? It seems like a genuinely likable bunch of cricketers, and you kind of need to nitpick to sort of bear a hate or grudge against any one of them.
Yeah, I mean, Owen Morgan's still a really hard guy in a way that, like, McCullum isn't. I remember he's so honest. I remember this brilliant interview he did in the Kolkata Telegraph years ago when I was out during the IPL, and it was like the first question to him was, how are you enjoying your time in Kolkata? And he's like, I'm not. And so the follow-up question was, oh, what don't you like about Kolkata? And he went into detail why he didn't like Kolkata. There's a sort of brilliant, pragmatic part of his personality we saw it at that press conference when they lost to England as well, you know. But he's kind of, you know, you've got him and you've got a little bit of Bairstow being grumpy and occasionally always thinking that the world's against him. But realistically, as George said, right, how could you not like Mark Wood, right? I mean, you know, someone like Liam Plunkett and Chris Wokes, and they've got a lot of guys in that team that I think are very entertaining cricketers, but also, I suppose, like almost non-threatening to a standard cricket fan, to a non-English cricket fan. And as George said earlier, they're, you know, hitting sixes everywhere and bowling fast. You know, there's a lot to like there. So I think if you take someone like Jimmy Anderson out of that lineup, it probably does change as well. Like, you know, Jimmy is so hard and a little bit more bitter than some of those other players. I think maybe that has changed as well. But they certainly, you know, having someone like Bayliss there as well, who is not, you know, he's not a sort of a dictator coach or a Andy Flower, you know, I must check every checklist. Just seems to be that they enjoy their cricket. And if they weren't England, if this wasn't an England team, I think they would be a lot of people's second favourite team around the world. But because it's England, and quite rightfully, I don't think that happens.
Like New Zealand are for pretty much everybody, irrespective of where you are in the world. That's something you're absolutely right in, that the fact that it's England, the fact that even a little thing or a little word in a press conference is enough to stir people and say, okay, what is he saying? Oh, this English lot should be beaten. Just moving on towards the end of the tournament, George, first up to you. They're just a couple of games away. They've been in this position before, believe it or not. It's been a long time since they've gotten this far, but they've been in this position before. They've faltered at the final hurdle. Do you think there is something different about this team in terms of going that final step, one step further? And even otherwise, will this campaign be labeled a success just for making it to the final four, because that's something that they've not achieved for so long now?
Well, I'll answer the last bit first. No, getting to the final four isn't good enough. It's an absolute bare minimum. Look, they have actually got to knockout stages fairly often. I mean, I remember them losing in the final of the Champions Trophy in 13, in the semi-final in 17, and of course, the final of the World T20. At least one of those games, I would probably argue both of the Champions Trophy games, I thought they got stage fright a little bit. I really do. I know that the pitches weren't exactly what they wanted, but, you know, that happens. I thought that the main issue with both of them was they got stage fright. Can I guarantee that won't happen again? Absolutely not. But, look, they're better than the teams that came before them. they're better than previous England sides. Some of them will really revel in the spotlight, which is a good sign. But they're up against really good sides. Look, England could bat first, play really well, but Virat Kohli could beat them. You know, if he plays his very best game, he can chase down a lot of targets. And a lot of the same things could be happening. So you're talking about very, very good sides, you know? Someone like Maxwell could come off in a final and win it. You can't be completely binary about how you judge success and failure. But I think, really, this England team needs a trophy. They really do need a trophy to show for the progress they've made and the changes they've brought to the international ODI side. And I think anything less than a trophy, if I'm really honest, will feel a bit of a disappointment. And I think from as the issues we've talked about in English cricket before, I'm not sure anything less than a trophy will really grab the public imagination in the way that's required.
Charlie, just concluding thoughts, not to get too far ahead. There's been some sections of the media where it's been written about that the Lord's track, which is where the final is, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but now that we're really, really close to it, the Lord's track isn't the most suitable for this English batting lineup for reasons that we've discussed already. Stats bear that out to a large extent. There was, of course, the whole Rabada thing a couple of years ago when he ran through them on an overcast-ish afternoon. Do you kind of feel that it could have been elsewhere, or do you still think there's going to be a wicket that suits them should they make the final, and that's going to be on the curator's mind? That's the one last question that's there in terms of how far these guys can go.
You know, I was there for the Australia England game, and I was there for the Australian New Zealand game. It seemed like pitches that were maybe 270 to, well, the Australia New Zealand game was probably even less, but the Australia England game was like a 270 to 320 pitch. But I've seen England play on a lot of pitches of that kind and score a lot more than you would expect. And so to say that, you know, unless it's going to be a very, very used pitch, which it won't be, and unless it's going to be very, very overcast or a little bit greener than it's, than usual, which, you know, not all that can be controlled by with the weather, I'm not sure that there's a particular fresh pitch for the final that's going to be a problem. It's going to be a slightly different situation. Semi-finals might be different, obviously, but for the actual final, I wouldn't think that's a problem. I still think that their biggest problem is they're going to go up against, you know, very, very good bowling teams. And I think very good bowling teams in very good form might be, you know, on any surface that helps them even helps those bowlers even slightly. That could be a bigger problem for England. But, I mean, at this stage, you've almost got to, you know, we're talking about three games of cricket, you know, so teams have to win two games, essentially. The pitches are going to be the pitches to a certain point. England have got their game plan. They're going to try and make more runs than Australia, India or New Zealand can make. That's essentially what they're going to try and do. That is their game plan. Whether they can pull that off or not is the big question. Until we get to Lords, we're not going to have any idea of that. And England may not even get that far. So it's an interesting game plan that they've gone with the whole time, but it's worked for them. It's just now whether it works for those last two games. I'm completely with George. I think that considering how brilliant they have been over the last couple of years and the fact that they did bottle it in the Champions Trophy, and also didn't win that World T20, but the Champions Trophy semi-final, I think was the one for me. I think basically when it comes down to it, if they don't win this trophy at this stage, I think it's going to be underperforming from them. And especially if a team like Australia, who's basically just putting it together at the last minute, does make the final and does actually win. I think that would be even worse considering that England have done so much right and still won't have taken that trophy away.
I actually don't think they played on a great wicket yet. Oh, sorry, they haven't played on the sort of wickets they wanted to play on yet in the tournament. See, we haven't seen the flat tracks we've seen in England over the last 3 or 4 years in this tournament. We haven't seen one of them. There have been some okay ones, but we haven't seen the ones where that you could absolutely annihilate bowlers without them having anything to do about it. You know, they just were getting no purchase at all on some of the tracks in Trent Bridge, for example. I mean, are they flat track bullies? It's not a yes and no answer, but there's definitely some truth in it. Are they going to get flatter tracks in these last two games, or one or two games? I don't know. The weather has been so bad in England. The groundsmen haven't had the time. The 10:30 starts would make it very difficult batting first, as did Owen Morgan, actually. And actually, it's proved to be the opposite. Pitches are deteriorating. And they just haven't been in English cricket for the last 3-4 years. So there's a new groundsman at Lord's. It'll be nothing like that surface, I'm sure, that we had for that South Africa game, which did all sorts of things. It's a slightly odd one, to be honest.
Yeah.
People are exaggerating the concerns about how the pitches will be. But yeah, England have to adapt. They much prefer playing on flat tracks. And this will test them. But, you know, it's a World Cup. It's meant to test you.
How they go in the next few days, we'll all wait and see. Of course, there's the semi-final to get through before we get to Lords for the final. George, one last question to you in terms of how the remaining pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, if you will, have come together nicely, because for a long time Wood was getting injured. We kept talking about how England lack a genuine fast bowler, and now pop comes Archer and becomes the leading wicket taker for England in any World Cup ever in a single edition. Has he kind of glued the remaining pieces of the puzzle together, and do they look a more complete side and a lot more threatening going into the last four?
Yeah, he's a very, very strong addition, isn't he? A huge addition. It's interesting, though, that people ask about Archer. Wood is every bit as quick. Until a couple of days ago, he had bowled the quickest ball of the tournament. I think Archer's now gone ahead of him again. And Wood has won fewer games. So they've actually, the key thing is they've got two fast bowlers. They've got two men who are bowling at 95 miles an hour, which gives them bite in the middle overs, which they didn't have. So there were lots and lots of times in the past where England were trying to score 400 and the opposition to get 380. And England never had an answer. Well, now they have some teeth. That attack does have some teeth. And Archer was probably the last piece in the jigsaw. And whether he should be playing, look, all I would say is he had a British passport from birth. His dad lived in Britain and I think worked on the underground. I don't know which generation or the generation after that. But Jofra's always had a British passport, never had a Barbadian passport. Personally, I'm not sure why he even had to qualify.
Ah, interesting. Jared, Archer's kind of led the narrative of fast bowling making a comeback. Wasn't that considered a weakness in general? Because you look at the numbers, you look at middle overs, you look at a guy who comes in and picks up a wicket instantly when the captain wants him to. Has he sort of been the X factor, not just for England, but in terms of a tournament narrative and a theme in terms of genuine express fast bowlers making a comeback on English wickets, which have been known to be, you know, run fests or flat ones over the last few years?
Well, the weird thing is, really, when you think about it, that, you know, of all the places where fast bowling would dominate, England is not the most likely. Generally, you know, it's been a problem for Australia at times. They bring over very fast bowlers, but you need skill usually in England, and you need to swing the ball and seam the ball and keep it straight. And realistically, in this tournament, you need to bowl really fast at someone's, you know, just between their nipple and their Adam's apple as much as you can, with the four men out square and behind the wicket. So it has been really interesting watching that change. But if you look at that team, I was shocked when people in the Caribbean during that series were going, I don't know if Archer should be picked, because he was such a perfect pick for England. They already had Chris Wokes in the power play. They needed one more strong power play bowler, which would have allowed then for Wood, Rashid, Plunkett, those guys to charge in after the power play and do what they do. It's as close to the best bowling attack that I think that England could probably put out, unless they wanted to, you know, bring back someone like Anderson. So I think it's a very, very, you know, good thing. And Archer's just great. I mean, who doesn't like watching him play cricket? He's a ridiculously talented human being. You watch him in the net sometimes bowling left arm wrist spin, and you're just like, there's actually something wrong with you, mate. I'm not sure what planet you came from, but you can nick off it.
Is it coming home? Because this seems like stuff of fairy tales, and that a team that is completely down in the dumps 4 years ago have kind of managed to stitch together a world-beating team at this stage. Whichever way this goes from here, as George says, nothing less than a trophy would suffice for an England side that has made it so far in tournaments before and Champions Trophies before. George, thanks a lot for joining. Appreciate your time.
Huge pleasure, anytime.
Thanks, Jared. Thanks as always. May you move away from the wild and into Manchester now.
One day, I hope to.
And that brings us to the end of yet another episode of Talking World Cup. Remember, leave us a rating on iTunes. It helps more people find our podcast. And of course, you can subscribe on Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Audio Boom, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcast from. Until next time then, it's goodbye from all of us at ESPN Cricket Info.